I'm Eric Scott. It's Monday, now Monday afternoon. And glad you tuned in this afternoon. Trying to get everything back together. January 10th already. There you are.
All day.
I know. I'm working on it. All right. Let's get right to it. You have a sweater on. You're not cold in here either.
No.
I don't know. It's me. It's funny. My wife always used to tease me about how I was never cold. And then lately, I've been like cold all the time. I don't know. Okay, let's get right to it. As you know, Monday's guest is Wolfboro Police Chief Dean Rondo.
Woohoo!
How are you?
Good. How are you? Happy New Year.
You enjoyed your holidays?
I did indeed. Thank you.
All right. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Beard's looking good.
It is. Thank you.
All right. Today, we're going to talk about accidents. Or motor vehicle accidents, actually, to be precise. Not any other kind of accidents. We have TV commercials for that. But anyway, so you were telling me that they're not actually accidents.
Well, in the law enforcement, so in the civilian world, this is where everybody, listen, wait a minute. Here, that was that collective eye roll of your audience. In the civilian world, you folks call them accidents. We call them crashes or collisions in law enforcement. An accident to us is what happened to you when you were in first grade.
Right.
Yes.
That's all right. Well,
motor vehicle crashes or collisions.
Okay. Now, is there like a grade of collisions or crashes when you dispatch help?
No. No, there isn't. So when we get a reported motor vehicle crash or collision, it's a standard package that rolls from the fire rescue department. And that's for obvious reasons, because you don't know what's going to happen. Even though it might be seemingly minor, you could have fuel leaks, you could have hazmat leaks. Somebody could, have a heart attack at the scene. That wouldn't be the first time that's happened. So you want these resources until such time as the incident commander, who is most normally the fire chief or deputy chief, releases the various pieces of apparatus. And then you're going to get a police officer. He's probably going to be, or she's probably going to be the first one there.
Okay. And how often do they happen in Wolfboro? I'm sure you don't have the exact number off the top of your head, but are there hundreds of crashes in Wolfboro?
So, interestingly enough, that's a great question. Years ago, there were a lot more motor vehicle crashes than there are today. Right? And I tell this story anecdotal. I remember there were days when I was a patrolman, this is going back 25 years ago, I would not get off of North or South Main Street, especially during the wintertime. It was not uncommon to have 5, 6, 7, 8 in a day. During storms. There's a lot of reason for that. What I personally believe is we took a different approach 25 years ago to enforcement operations than we do today. And we took a different approach to the investigation of motor vehicle crashes 25 years ago. And we didn't really hold bad drivers accountable for their behavior. A lot of that changed when I became a sergeant, and the guidance that I put out to when I was in charge of the patrol division was, look, if somebody causes a crash or a collision, it's a clear violation of law, we can determine that, then they need to get a ticket or they need to be arrested. And this business of walking away from crashes with the idea that, well, let the insurance companies battle it out. If we can make a determination, so following too closely, stop sign violation, a failure to yield of some sort, reckless or negligent driving, speed, whatever the case may be, that person needs to be held accountable. Because the only way we change bad behavior is through some punitive measure. And when we started doing that, in about 2 years' time, we started seeing a lot less crashes. And then, of course, things happen. We started picking up some highway safety grants. We put more police officers out on the road using federal funds. And we began, strict motor vehicle enforcement. And what that means is that, if we saw a bad act, and it happened in our presence, we responded to it. Now, they might have gotten a warning, or they could have gotten a summons. They may have received a summons. But the point is, we took an action. There was an enforcement action. The vehicle was stopped. The bad behavior was corrected one way or another, either through a warning or through a summons or arrest. And then, you know, life went on. What that ended up doing over about a 10-year period of time is driving those motor vehicle crashes down. I just did the statistics for the commission, and the month of November, December, we had 13 motor vehicle crashes in Wolfboro. I want to say that the year-end statistic is running about 130 to 160 crashes in a year. So, I mean, and that's because I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but it's in that neighborhood. So we'll do 130 divided by 12. That's 10.83 crashes per month. That seems a little high, but that's what it is. And if you do 160 divided by 12, you're at 13.33. So the summer months clearly are our busiest.
Sure.
And then, you know, January through March, it's not uncommon for that number to go down to zero, and then we'll pop back up into the double digits. But yeah, we're somewhere in the double digits every month during the summertime.
So it's a significant part of a police officer's day.
Oh yes.
Or week to attend to these traffic crashes.
Oh yes. Yes it is. Okay.
Now, you don't necessarily keep stats on the severity of the crashes.
We do.
Oh, you do?
We do. We do indeed. Yes, we do.
How many of them are fender benders as opposed to what I would call a crash?
So the vast majority, believe it or not, are reasonably minor.
Okay.
Okay, and what I mean by that is that, you know, nobody had to go to the hospital. And my definition of minor may be different from yours, but in this case, you know, even though there may have been some significant property damage, nobody had to go to the hospital. Nobody died. And so that to us is a reasonably minor motor vehicle crash. In terms of fender benders, what you would call the bumping or the low velocity collision, something, you know, backing accident that occurs in Hunter's IGA or something like that. Those are probably maybe 10%.
Oh, I figured there'd be more than that.
No, we respond to some pretty serious, in terms of property damage, motor vehicle crashes. Last year, I believe we had two fatalities. We had one in College Road. That was just a tragedy. And then we had one on Center Street, where the woman in that crash, and I did the analysis. Myself and Staff Sergeant Maloney did the analysis on that. So we're the two technical crash reconstructionists for Wolfboro. she had a medical situation ongoing, and it caused her to essentially either pass out or seize behind the wheel of the motor vehicle, and she caused a fairly significant head-on collision on Center Street. Mm. And the impact speed we calculated was somewhere around 90 miles an hour or so.
Oh my.
So that was a fairly serious motor vehicle crash. Vehicles now are designed a lot differently than they were, say, even 10 or 20 years ago. They're designed to crumple and absorb that energy. You know, when you talk to a crash reconstructionist, it's all to us, it's all about energy loss and conservation of energy. That's how we look at these crashes, and that's how we put these crashes back together again. So these motor vehicles are designed to do just that, to crumple.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it absorbs a lot of energy in the process. That's what keeps you safe.
Yeah, you see it a lot if you look at pictures of some accidents. You'll see the front part of the car completely destroyed, but the passenger cage is in one piece.
Is intact, and exactly. You know, it's funny because to the average citizen who, you know, doesn't really know a whole lot about how vehicles are built these days, was, well, it doesn't take much to really crack up the vehicles. You know, back in my day, they were made out of Detroit steel. Well, that's what was causing all the injuries, right? There was no give. So there was an awful lot of energy transference. If you're the medium between you and the rear of the vehicle, that energy is going directly through you. These vehicles today are designed to do just that. They're designed to crumple up like a big, cannoli. And that's what you want. You want that thing crushing. And that's why you see these horrific, terrible crashes, right? Pieces, parts of the vehicle are everywhere. The vehicles are all crunched up, but the people are fine, right? A few bangs and maybe a little unnerved, but they're essentially fine. And that's the difference.
Let's start at the beginning. What is a technical crash reconstructionist?
So a technical crash reconstructionist is somebody that has been through the technical crash reconstruction course of study and has passed either the state exam or the national exam, if you want to be a national reconstructionist. And it's the use of applied science, math and physics and geometry and trigonometry and algebra. Some calculus. Involved in a process, scientific process that's been proven and accepted by the courts, mm-hmm. To put these crashes back together again, and it's a lot of things, but that's essentially it. It's using applied math and physics to put these crashes back together again.
Other than insurance companies, of course, wanting to know what happened. What is the reason that it's so important to put these back together and reconstruct the crash?
That's a great question. So for a number of reasons, the first and foremost is a service to the community. I will tell you as a technical crash reconstructionist, anytime there's a motor vehicle crash, there is some fault, right? Someone is at fault. Now the fault may be shared between two different drivers, but there's some fault, usually over input of a control of some flavor, braking, steering, or acceleration. But someone's wrong. Someone's at fault. That's number one. Number two, if there's a fatality or serious bodily injury involved, or even serious property damage, there are probably going to be criminal charges filed. And we use this to prove the criminal case. Lastly, if there is a fatality, we have to account for what happened. Why is that person dead and they shouldn't be?
Okay. Is there a, or is it part of the reconstruction process? For instance, my brother, 6-7 years ago, lady actually hit a piece of ice, jumped the curb, took out his front porch.
Yep.
It wasn't, she wasn't arrested for it. It was her fault, but, there was a significant amount of property damage.
So let's talk about that. So in the motor vehicle statute, unlike the criminal statute, intent is not necessarily a factor. Okay. So let's go back to, shows past where I would always say, hey, you have to have intent to commit a crime, right? And mm-hmm. if you go back to my old analogy of Perry Mason, he was always talking about, the killer's motive and the killer's intent, right? The culpable state of mind, right? So in this case, you got, negligently, recklessly, knowingly, and purposely, okay? Well, those four culpable states of mind may not necessarily be important in a motor vehicle. In the motor vehicle code, because in the motor vehicle code, culpable state of mind is not a requirement. All right, so you just have the elements of the offense. The reason for that is because you have to take due care when you drive. We learn that in driver's education when we go through the driver training. Driving is a privilege, it's not a right. You have to exercise due care and due caution. So you assume that responsibility when you get behind the wheel of the car. So in this particular case, in your brother's example, this woman was probably going too fast when she hit the ice and jumped the curb. Had she been going slower for the conditions, there probably would have been no accident. Now, the police department may have found that counterproductive to cite her for speeding and just figured that the insurance company would do it. And that's what happens in a lot of cases. if that happened here in Wolfboro, we'd probably do some sort of investigation.
Okay. So you'd look for a... You don't not necessarily get carted off to jail for something like that.
No, you're not going to get carted off to jail, but you might get a speeding ticket. It'll be a violation level offense, but it's going to show fault. It's going to be a clear indication of fault.
Okay.
Right. So as I tell my police officers, right, because we this happens about three or four times a year where I'll be talking to one of my police officers about a case and say, look, cars typically don't cross the center line. When you have an automobile crossing the center line, or in your case, jumping a curb, right, we need to find out why. Why did that happen? Because that's not normal. Right. There's a violation here. There's a violation of law. Oftentimes, you'll see this in DWI crashes. You know, and I'm constantly pounding through the heads of my patrol officers that, look, vehicles typically don't drive head-on into each other. They don't do that.
Thankfully, no.
Okay, so we need to ask the question, why? Why did these two cars have a head-on collision on Center Street, for example? Why did that happen? That's not normal. Why did the vehicle jump the curb and end up in a porch, right? That's not normal, okay? Why is that? And then I'll go, maybe he had a seizure. Well, maybe he did. Do we know? Well, no. Go find out. You know, and that's the point I'm trying to get at. Look, when we have these crashes, we shouldn't write them off. Well, it was just an accident. No, an accident is what you had in first grade. We don't have accidents. We have crashes or collisions. Let's do an investigation and let's find out.
A lot of people automatically call the police with any kind of crash. Is that required, or is that something that's just kind of been passed down as learned behavior?
Yeah, I think that's learned behavior. That's not required. Is it a good idea? Yeah, generally speaking, it's a good idea. But it's not required, no. So the requirement in the state of New Hampshire for a quote-unquote reportable crash, one that must be reported to the state, is any crash that exceeds $1,000.
Now, when the local police take the report, does that qualify as reporting the accident?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So there's not a separate form.
Not a separate form, right. So we'll come in, we'll fill out the form for you. That's the crash report that we fill out. Now, it doesn't take much, because I told you, starting about 10, 15 years ago, we started designing cars to crumple like cannolis, right? So it doesn't take much to get to $5,000. I just had the rear bumper of my pickup truck replaced, and I want to say that was about $5,000, right?
Wouldn't
there.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. So, and that was a simple backing accident where I was plowing my driveway a couple of years ago, and I backed into my tree. Okay, I backed into a tree on my property. So it doesn't take much for a crash to be reportable. But the requirement is that the drivers simply exchange their driver license information with one another and their phone number and their insurance company if they have one. That's it.
Why do you think that this is one of only, I believe, two states that don't require auto insurance?
I have no idea. I wish we would stop that.
The libertarian in me is a big fan of mandatory insurance, because to me, you take responsibility when you drive.
Some people
disagree.
I'm right with you. I wish they would, they would join the 21st century in that regard. Having no insurance to drive a motor vehicle is in this state is just wrong. It's just wrong. Pardon me.
Do you find that most of the crashes that you investigate are insured?
No.
Really?
Yeah, about half.
That many?
Yeah, yeah. And that's bad. That's bad.
All right, well, so let's kind of walk through this. You have the accident. Or the crash, I should say.
Yeah.
The accident comes later.
The accident comes later, yeah.
So the police officer comes in, and is there a standard form?
Yep. Yeah, we have a standard form. Yes, that's correct. It's a state form under seal. It's what I call the long form. So you have a reportable crash. The officer's gonna collect all the information. He's gonna do a diagram. He's gonna write his narrative. He's gonna look for witness statements. All just like you would do any other type of investigation. You know, he may go to the hospital and talk to you at the hospital and talk to the other person at the hospital. But yeah, he'll take photos and all that stuff. He'll make sure the vehicles get recovered and they get removed, and the scene then, you know, falls to us in the fire department to make sure the rest of the scene is cleaned up. Any hazmat material is mitigated that may have spilled, like radiator fluid or gasoline or what have you. So
is that why when there's a severe crash that the area is shut down for hours?
Yes, it could be that.
Allow for that reconstruction?
Yes, that, and exactly. So one, we have to make sure the scene is safe before we let vehicles go back on it. So any hazmat's got to be cleaned up or remediated. We're sweeping up glass and picking up pieces of debris and plastic and metal and so forth and so on. But yeah, let's go back about 6 months ago. I was actually coming back from the police academy after teaching all day technical crash reconstruction, of all things, and there was this serious motor vehicle accident on South Main Street down by the boat museum. And so I responded down there, it happened to be a fatality, so we shut that road down so we could, you know, measure skid marks and get the drag sled out, pull the road, what is called pulling the road. We're measuring the coefficient of friction along the roadway surface, taking photographs and measurements. So we're going to be working in the road, getting all of these measurements and factors and so forth, and then doing, you know, our voodoo witchcraft there to figure out what the speeds were.
Okay.
But that's the purpose of that.
And how long do you go to school for that?
Well, how long do we go to school for that?
Yeah.
Is that what you... Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Yeah, so it's a long time. a long time. It is four blocks of instruction. The first one you get at the academy. Everybody gets it. It's called Zero Block. You get it as part of your recruit training. This is in every state in the union, by the way. It's the same thing. It's pretty standardized. And then and that's where most officers, like 95% of the officers, never go beyond that.
Okay.
And then there's three other courses. There's the what is called on-scene crash investigation, and they all build upon one another, so you must go through them in this order. On-scene crash investigation, then technical reconstruction, then traffic crash reconstruction. And each one is 2 weeks long. They are intense. They are intense. And in fact, a lot of officers who are working toward their bachelor's degrees will take these courses, and they actually get college credit for them at the undergrad level. Ooh. And it's quite a few credits, like 12 to 14 for the math. The math is intense. And I do mean intense.
Now, is that working time, or do you have to take that?
That is training that you go to. You're sent, and they're minimum 2 weeks long.
Okay.
2 weeks long. Each one is 2 weeks long, and you are doing a lot of homework at night. I would come home. So when I went through, I started, you know, years ago. Obviously, I've been doing this for a while. But I would do 3 to 4 hours of homework a night for 2 weeks. Yeah, this was a lot of work. This was a lot of work, and it's all pure mathematics.
Hmm.
I'll say applied. Basically, it's applied physics is what it is.
Horrible, horrible words.
Yeah, it's a lot of they warn you right up front when you in the course curriculum, and who teaches it at the, so the way the New Hampshire Police Academy works is that they'll have guys like me come down and help put on courses and train students. But what they'll do for these courses is they'll they'll go to Northwest Traffic Institute or the University of Northern Florida that have the traffic institutes that are actually run out of those organizations, and they'll hire their instructors to come out and teach. And these, you know, a lot of these teachers are men and women who were law enforcement officers, retired, went and you know, either had a degree in mathematics or went and got a degree in mathematics after having gone through the training. One of my instructors for two out of my three courses had his master's in mechanical engineering. So that's what you see. You see a lot of men and women like that that find this really fascinating and get into it. In fact, I made a statement, right? So I'm gonna talk a little funny story. When I first when I was first going to this course, my sergeant at the time, a guy named Sergeant Lato, he said, and he had been through the course, and he had said, do you have a strong background in mathematics? And I said, I do. And he said, okay, what is it? Have you had college-level algebra? I said, I have, and geometry and calculus, and I had. And he said, okay. So he signed off on my approval to go, and I got down there. And now, I had been a couple of years, two or three years out of the Army at this point, so I hadn't been using a lot of math at the time, so it was a little rusty. And one of my classmates was from Alton Police Department, and she had a bachelor's of science in applied mathematics, right? So we were going to this course together, right? And when you get down there, they give you a pretest, and just to see where you're at, so they can gauge the student, so they know what level to start teaching at. And I want to say that on the pretest, I got a 55.
That doesn't sound good.
And no. And I'm like, oh my gosh, she got a 70. So the instructor said, actually did pretty good. And I said, I got a 55. So you should see the rest of the class. I go, oh. And she got a 70, and she had a degree in applied. My degree is in history and political science. Hers was in applied mathematics. So when I say the math is intense, the math is intense. You really, you know, and you know, the math came back to me as I started getting into it. Everything made sense. The second class was even funnier. So a couple of years later, in between wars, I go back to the for the second block of instruction, right? The second 2 weeks of hell, and now, so, oh, by the way, my final grade was 92. Hers was 96, but mine was 92 on the first one. On the second one, much higher, and my final grade was a 98. But here's a funny story. So after 2 weeks of intense training and mathematics, we're sitting down, the whole class, and this is a three-hour exam at the end, right? You have to pass the exam. And passing was 80 or better. And I took this very seriously because I knew the mathematics, the concepts and the process that I was going to do theoretically could put somebody in prison. So I was really wanted to be 100%, right? To me, there was no room for error. But that was how I saw life, and still do. And but I will never forget this, because I'm sitting in class and we're about now 10 minutes out from starting the final exam, which you obviously had to pass with an 80 or more, 80 or better. And I feel this nudge on my right shoulder, and I turn around, and it was one of the guys. He was actually with me in the first class, and he was a police officer from Londonderry. I think it was a sergeant. And he says, "Hey, Dean, you understand this stuff pretty good. I go, well, yeah, I'd like to think I do. I'm trying. I'm a little apprehensive about the exam right now. And he says, I need some help. I said, okay, what can I help you with? He said, I don't understand. I go, okay, you don't understand what? What don't you understand? Let me see if I can help you. I don't understand, hello, class, and welcome to your second block of instruction on technical crash reconstruction. I said, are you kidding me? You don't understand anything since the first day. He says, not a thing. Said, dude, there's nothing I can do for you. You're not going to pass. There is not. You should have said something long before now. He didn't make it.
I guess not.
He did not make it. No, I don't know what happens. I don't know what happens in that situation. But all I know is I made it, and I took every bit of 3 hours. Every bit.
Now, of these roughly, what do we figure, 130 traffic crashes in Wolfboro every year,
yeah,
how many of them require the services of a reconstructionist?
Not that many. Maybe 2%.
Okay, which is
2%, 3%.
A couple.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we'll say maybe 3 or 4 if you want a specific number. Yeah.
Now, what if you have an accident or crash, pardon me, in a place that doesn't have a reconstructionist?
Oh, well.
I don't know if you guys do work for other municipalities.
We can. If somebody were to call us and said, hey, we have a terrible motor vehicle crash, can you come here and help us investigate? We would, under mutual aid, we would do that for anybody.
Okay.
Okay, we would do that. And, you know, we're not going to take over their investigation for them, but we will walk them through the process, and we will do the heavy lifting from the reconstruction side for them if they didn't have that capability. Let me tell you one of the reasons why, when I say it's a service to the community. So years ago, I'm reminded of a crash I investigated years ago. This is on Laner Street and Union Street, where Union and Laner meet. There was a vehicle that was heading, we'll call it northwest on Laner Street, and then there was a vehicle heading toward the community center, essentially heading, we'll call it northeast, if you will, coming down Union Street toward the community center, and there was a T-bone crash right there at the intersection. And you know, the old adage is, well, if it's a T-bone, the vehicle that crashed into the driver's side door, if you will, would have been the offending vehicle. And in this particular case, it was a woman. She was just picking up her son from carpenter school, was on her way back to wherever she was going in North Wolfboro, and got into this crash. Well, when I arrived on the scene, I was the second officer. I noticed that there was a very lengthy set of skid marks. And this is one of the very first crashes that I investigated. And I still remember the length of the skid marks. It was 88 feet of skid mark. And so I said, I think, you know, and I wasn't the senior officer at the time. So I said, let me take this investigation and let me do this, because I think we've got these skid marks are really long for this street, for the speed limit, and that it shouldn't be that way. And so I end up getting the drag sled and pulling the road and getting the coefficient of friction and doing the math. And so I'm in the process of doing the reconstruction. It took, you know, a few days. But in the meantime, we got a call from the insurance company, and they were going to cite the woman. And it was her insurance company, and they were going to assign 100% fault. I said, hang on. Let me do the reconstruction. Let me finish my report. You know, let me get it peer evaluated, and then you'll get a copy of it. But in the meantime, why don't you have one of your, I think it was Allstate Insurance, have your technical crash reconstructionist on staff, have him or her give me a call, and you know, we'll talk about this on the phone. So a couple of days later, they did, and they said, okay, we'll wait out. And they got my report, and they found the other driver at fault. And the reason it was important to do that is because this woman would have been, she would have been held accountable for this very bad crash, which injured, where in this crash, the passenger, one of the passengers of the now offending vehicle had serious shoulder injuries that became lifelong permanent injuries. So she theoretically and certainly her insurance company would have been on the hook for that, if you will, had I not been able to come there and say, ooh, this doesn't make sense. This 88 feet of skid mark is really bothering me. Let me do the investigation. I was able to show by doing time distance calculations that when she was pulling out after stopping, and that became one of the issues. Well, she didn't stop at the stop sign. No, she stopped at the stop sign because it's the only way the math works out. And what had happened, I was able to I changed everything to velocity, feet per second, and was able to show that when she pulled out and it looked right and then left and right again and began, the vehicle had covered an incredible distance because they were going very, very fast down Lanner Street, you know, in excess of 60 miles an hour. And they covered that ground very quickly, and they didn't have time. She started pulling out, and they didn't have time to stop, and they actually drove in front of her. Caused the crash. So those things happen, and that's why you do the math.
Now, do you get or could you be requested to do an investigation by an insurance company?
Yes, we could. We could be asked to do that. In this particular case, it was funny. Let me go on. In this case, I'm talking about the offending driver fought the whole case. It went to district court, and she was found guilty in district court. The offending driver was. So that was a beautiful thing behind it. So I got to do all the math in court.
And it held up.
Oh, it held up, yeah. Yeah, because it makes sense. So it's all applied math and physics, right? I mean, this is pretty simple stuff. And it held up, yeah. So I've had cases that I've explained cases in Superior Court as well. But yes, I've been asked. In fact, I've been asked by defense counsels to testify in various crashes and so forth.
Okay, and that doesn't happen very often.
No, that doesn't happen very often either.
Okay, because, you know, anybody who's ever, like, you know, last week I wasn't feeling well, and daytime TV is littered with ads for lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, what are they? So everybody who's home during the day has automatically had a traffic accident or crash and was hurt in it. Or what was the other one? It's my money and I want it now.
Oh, that J.G. Wentworth.
Yeah, if you're selling, yeah, monthly payments or whatever it is.
Yeah, annuities and mortgages.
Believe me, if they spend that much money in advertising it, I'm not sure how good it could be. I don't know. I worry about some of those ads. But anyway, be that as it may. So we're talking about or crashes or collisions here on WASR with Police Chief Dean Rondo, the Wolfboro Police Department. How much of that, besides the Block Zero training, what type of training do Wolfboro officers have access to?
Well, they have access to all of it.
Okay.
The math, to be honest with you, the math scares them.
I can understand that.
Staff Sergeant Maloney came to me when he was detective, came to me years ago. This was funny. I think I was still a lieutenant. I was a lieutenant. And I was the only reconstructionist we had in the certified reconstructionist we had in the department. Though we had a couple of guys that had already been through the first two blocks of instruction, they didn't want to go anymore, right? They hit their limit with that trigonometry, I guess. And so he says, I want to do this. And I said, okay. He said, will you help me? And I go, yeah, of course I will. So there was a couple of weekends where I came in where he says, listen, meet me at the station. I'm having a lot of difficulty with time distance. And I'm like, okay. You know, I'll come in and we'll do some time distance work and get you familiar and get you, you know, ready for this. And he did well. He did well. In fact, he is now a technical crash reconstructionist himself. And we teach at the academy, he and I. And we've also been through, he and I went through the motorcycle crash investigation course, which was daunting because motorcycles are a completely different animal.
Sure.
They're a completely different vehicle.
Wonderful little invention.
Articulated, two-wheeled vehicles that they are. Yeah, very. Yeah, there's a lot to motorcycles. But yeah, we went through that. Of course, we went through it because, you know, we have to be able to investigate motorcycle fatalities, which I have.
How does investigating fatalities and things like that play into your home life? Like, I remember when my children got their driver's license, and I was already, worried. For somebody who sees what you've seen on the roads and some of the stupid thing the drivers do, how do you prevent them from just handcuffing them to the radiator and say, wait till you're 21?
There is that, right? I mean, and it's the same way with my wife right now, you know, there is that, right? And you're absolutely correct. You can try to explain the concepts, and they're going to look at you like, yeah, you got six heads.
Well, you're indestructible at 17.
You know, and I was talking about my wife.
Oh.
No, my kids too. You know, it's hard. You know, it really is hard because you know the dangers. You know, I have friends of mine, since you brought this up, he asked folks. But, you know, I'll be at, you know, really good friends of ours for dinner in Tuftonboro, and I'll notice that they didn't lock the door. I'll get up and I'll lock the door. They go, why are you doing that? It's Tuftonboro. I said, I don't care. The door's staying locked. You know, and it's exactly what you're getting at. It's what we've seen, what we've been experienced to over time, which has jaded us. And, you know, this is the reason when I was in Iraq, for example, in 2003 and then later in 2008, when I had to go from point A to point B, I was driving myself, right? Now, I was a major at the time in 2003 and 2008. I was a lieutenant colonel. I was assigned a driver. And command sergeant major used to get mad at me all the time. Yeah, Major Rondo, you got a driver. You need to let that driver drive you. Command sergeant major, nobody has more experience at driving than me. No one. I will drive myself. And he would get really upset. You know, sir, that's not what the Army gave you that driver for. Well, that's a, he can pull security, Command Sergeant Major. Thank you very much. I am driving. And, you know, it's in if I'm going to go from point A to point B, I've got the most training. I'm driving. And that was the way I looked at it, because I'm going to be responsible. Mm-hmm. I want to be responsible. But it's all part and parcel about what you just, getting back to what you just said, right? It's what we've seen, what we've been experienced to, what we know, and you can't impart that. Unfortunately, you can't take all that knowledge, that 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years worth of collective wisdom in that particular case and impart it in a nanosecond into somebody. You just can't. And, you know, when I teach down at the academy, you know, there's a big block of instruction on perception reaction time and what that is, how to calculate that, what that is. And I'll talk to them about that. And I know from experience, my human reaction time is really short because I'm a police officer, right? And it comes with the territory. My wife's, on the other hand, it's really long. Hers is like 2.5, 2.7 seconds. Oh, my God. I'm white-knuckled when I get in a car with her. Because her perception reaction, her human reaction time is really long. She doesn't react as fast as I do.
And it gets longer as you get older.
And it gets longer as you get older. That's correct.
For some strange reason, the older you get, the bigger the car you drive. I haven't figured that one out yet either. But maybe it's different now that they don't make Crown Victorias anymore.
Well, we want our comfort, right?
We feel
as though we've earned it, you know.
Yeah, actually, that's...
Plus, I don't know about you, but I'm 58, and I'm having difficulty getting in and out of things.
I understand. That's why I don't own sports cars anymore.
Yeah, my point exactly.
Yeah, 1247 here on WASR. We're talking about accidents. When I ask people, what's the biggest contributor to accidents or to crashes? A lot of people will tell me speed.
Yeah.
Is it speed? Is it, when I was growing up, and even now that I've had a few years of driving under my belt, sometimes you can get in as much trouble with a brake pedal as you can with a gas pedal.
Well, that's true. I will tell you that every crash is due to over input of a control, either braking, steering, or acceleration. Of the three, I would say acceleration, okay, is the number one cause. If you wanted a breakdown, you know, that's my opinion, my professional opinion.
That's okay.
The conclusion I've drawn over the 26 years or so that I've been a police officer.
But usually, all right, well, let's kind of walk through it. You get the call on the radio. There's been an accident or a crash.
Yep.
Pardon
yep.
me. The corner of walk and don't walk.
Yep.
What's the first thing you're looking for besides the fact that everyone's not injured and they have valid driver's licenses and all of that?
So as a reconstructionist or as the first arriving?
As the first arriving police officer.
So the first arriving police officer, his or her job is going to be to protect the scene, right? And they're going to be calling in status updates to fire rescue that are probably a couple of minutes behind them. So they're going to be calling in statuses on the patient, if you will, the victims, so forth and so on. They're going to be reporting back what they see. That way everybody can start getting kind of a mental picture as to what they need to do and what tasks need to be accomplished once they get there. So the first arriving officer, he or she is going to protect the scene and keep other people from getting injured, right? Once fire rescue gets there and the patients have been removed and somebody like me shows up, if there's a fatality or serious bodily injury, and the first thing I'm going to do is scratch my head and go, oh, man, what the hell happened here? Mm-hmm. Once I get past that, hopefully somebody brings me a cup of coffee, and because it's going to be a long day and I'm going to be out there. And the first thing I'm looking for is the forensic evidence at the scene. You know, I'm looking for points of impact. I'm looking for the area of impact. I'm looking for skid marks, yaw marks. These are all different types of marks. I'm looking for what? I'm looking for causation of the crash.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I have found what I'm looking for and other resources start to arrive, I'm going to start having the whole scene documented, photographs. I'm going to make a determination. Do I need to bring in a total station to do a 3D documenting of the crash scene so I can plug it into the computer? I'm definitely pulling the road, going to get a coefficient of friction on the roadway surface, and we'll start taking measurements at that point.
Now, sometimes there are bits of data you wouldn't be able to assess. For
That's
instance,
correct.
If it was snowing, by the time you got to that, the road conditions could be completely different from at the time of the crash.
That's a very good point. That is a challenge up here in the Northeast. That's correct.
Or rain or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever. All of that changes the coefficient of friction on the roadway right. surface. Absolutely.
Or a snowplow comes by, whatever.
Well, we would block that off, yeah. If it's that serious, right, the road is shut down, the snowplows aren't coming through until I'm done collecting what I need to collect.
Okay. Now, let's go back to what most of us are familiar with as far as a fender bender accident or a backing accident in mm-hmm. a parking lot or whatever. The officer comes down, takes a report, gives it a report number,
mm-hmm.
And then, as far as I've noticed, it's kind of filed and forgotten at that point. The insurance company gets a copy, and then they make their own decision from there.
That is indeed correct. You are 100% correct on everything you said.
And how much of that police time does that take? Because usually they'll tell you, well, the report will be ready in 2 or 3 or 4 days. Or whatever.
More like weeks.
Well, sometimes.
Yeah. So that little report there, that little fender bender, if you will, if it's a minor fender bender and we're not talking about any injuries and nothing had to be towed from the scene, you're probably talking a good 2.5-3 hours.
Still, even for something that minor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I would assume that the amount of time expended goes up exponentially.
It does.
With damage.
This motor vehicle crash that occurred now almost 2 years ago, on South Main Street here, the one that was in front of the hospital. That crash scene was about 3 miles long from where it began up by the high school. There were five cars involved in that, plus a house, a stone wall, a house sign. That took a long time to investigate. That took a very long time to investigate. So you're talking months in that particular case.
How deep does that kind of thing go? I mean, what are you investigating?
Well,
at that level,
we're looking at a lot of things. We're looking at so first of all, let's go back to the original statement, right? that I made. You know, cars just don't crash into other cars. Cars don't crash into stone walls and signposts, and then, you know, cross the center line and drive into the porch of the of a house at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk, right? I mean, cars just don't do that. So why did this car do that? Why did this driver cause this car to crash into five other cars, cause all the serious bodily injury and property damage and so forth and so on? So there's a huge investigation. You know, we could be pulling black boxes, the event data module. Right,
cars.
Crashed at them all. Yeah, so all cars made post 1996 have what is called an event data recorder, or a crash data recorder, and it's what activates the airbags, and in some cases the airbags and the seatbelts, but the airbags in the vehicles, and that event data recorder contains an awful lot of information. There's an awful lot of really good information in that. And that can be exploited. You know, we can download that data and we can draw conclusions from that data. And it gives us 3 seconds before and 2 seconds after crash. And so we'll be looking at things like that. We'll be looking at collecting all of the skid marks and doing all of the analysis and pulling the coefficient of friction along the roadway surface with a drag sled, and be mindful that the same road can have different coefficient of friction depending on where the crash occurred.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things that is beaten into our head that speed causes accidents.
That's correct, yeah. No, that's true. That's, I would say that's a true statement.
Is there such a thing as going too slow and causing...
Yes.
As accidents?
Well, what it is is if you go too slow, what you're going to do is you're going to cause somebody to get frustrated. They're going to try to pass, and that's going to result in a crash.
Okay. I'm talking more like on a highway, you know, like...
Yeah, that's where you see it. That's exactly what happens, yeah. So if you don't want to go the speed limit, that's fine. Pull over and let people pass you. Who do?
Right.
You want to go the speed limit. If you want to drive, you know, lower than the speed limit and get over on the right lane. If it's a multi-lane highway. So let's talk about this real quick. Okay. Let's talk about a three-lane highway. You got the far right lane, the middle lane, and the far left lane.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the right lane, if you want to go slow and you want to go the speed limit or lower, you get in the right lane. The middle lane is the cruising lane. Okay. The left lane is for passing.
Right.
All right. Once you pass, you get either back over in the middle lane or the far right lane. Period, stop, end of discussion. That's the way the roadway system is set up. If you are driving the speed limit in the far left lane, you're wrong. You're wrong, and get over. That's for passing. That's a passing lane.
Isn't that the law now, or is that the move over law?
It's always been the law.
Different?
It's always been the law. It's been like that since my dad had his license.
Well, I remember hearing about it in driving school, and that was about 40 million years ago.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's my point exactly. Yeah. It's always been that way. That's the way it was designed.
I didn't know if the move over law had anything to do with that.
No, it's just we're emphasizing this get over into the far right lane. You know, in Germany, if they'll actually run you off the road if you're doing that. The Germans take this stuff really seriously. They'll run you off the road. Yeah, you don't want to be going slow in the left lane. That's not good.
Well, I can imagine, especially on parts of the Autobahn without a speed limit.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, get over. Don't be doing, you know, 55 or 60 in a far left lane. That's meant for passing. If you want to do that, get in the middle lane or the far right lane.
In our remaining couple of minutes, how many, or could you be a rough percentage of crashes that are caused by alcohol?
Oh, I can't. I don't know that statistic off the top of my head.
Rough percentage.
I really can't because I don't. Anything I say would be wrong. I will tell you that on average, depending on the year, I'll give you a range that we have anywhere, from 30 to 50 DWIs, and that's a very rough estimate in Wolfboro on an annual basis, anywhere from 30 to 50. Not all of those end in car crashes.
Right. But thankfully.
Thankfully. I couldn't give you any specific estimate.
What is the best advice you can give somebody to avoid a crash, besides slow down?
Okay, well, follow the rules of the road, right? That's the best advice I can give you. All right, follow the rules of the road. I can't begin to tell you. So here's a good one that will keep people really safe. And I see this all the time, I'll tell you where it happens a lot. It happens up here at the golf course.
Oh, I think I know where you're going.
Yeah, so people will be driving. Now, remember, it's a 30-mile-an-hour zone in there, mm-hmm. right, which means that people are doing 40. Right? That's just what it is. That's just what it is, folks. People are doing 40 and a 30, right? And if the state DOT director was here, he'd tell you the same thing, okay? So here's what happens. Now, this is a great example of perception reaction and human reaction time issues. Driver's going down the road, maybe doing 30, 35, 32, 33 miles an hour. And there's a steady stream of cars behind that one driver. We'll call that person driver A, right? And driver A is driving down 32, 33 miles an hour, and he sees a couple of golfers at either side of the road,
mm-hmm.
right? One on the far left, and they're heading toward the high school, right? One on the far left and one on the right. And he says, oh, I got a couple of golfers, and they want to cross the street. Wow, I'll be a nice guy, and I'll slow down and stop for them, and I'll let them cross the road. Now, there's no crosswalk there. But he sees him standing by the road, so he's going to... So what does he do? He mashes the brake.
Mm-hmm.
Remember what I said, over input of a control? He's braking now. Puts on the brake. Meanwhile, about 40, 50 feet back, right, which is a goodly distance, right?
Yeah.
Is some guy... And he's on his way back to work, coming from the dentist office or a doctor's appointment at Huggins Hospital. And he's thinking about the report that he's got to get out on the end of quarter numbers, and he's got to have on his boss's desk by 5 o'clock today. And then the next thing you know, he's looking at the taillights of the guy in front of him who's stopped for these two golfers that are now crossing the street. He dynamites his brake, and kapow, we have a rear-end collision.
Unfortunately, I'm going to have to end it there. But thank you for the story. Dean Rondo, ladies and gentlemen, Chief of the Wolfboro Police Force, 1 o'clock news is next.